Shalom and welcome again to another edition of the Jewish Sacred Aging Podcast. A reminder that you can follow Jewish Sacred Aging on our website, www.jewishsacredaging.com, and also on the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. On today's podcast, we are very pleased to welcome Rabbi Mark Katz of Beth Elohim in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and we're here to talk about his contribution to a very, very powerful book called The Sacred Encounter, Jewish Perspectives on Sexuality. It's a CCAR Press book, part of their CCAR Challenge and Change series. Rabbi Katz, welcome to the podcast microphone of Jewish Sacred Aging. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's good to speak with you. And your contribution is part of this very, very interesting anthology and almost, I guess it's fair to say, history in many ways of Jewish approaches to sex and sexuality, representing various aspects of our tradition. So let me start right away with an essay called The Kavanah of the Bedroom, Sex and Intention in Jewish Law. I think you know the author, Rabbi Mark Katz. The Kavanah of the Bedroom, there's a quote in there I think that you use from Maimonides, which says, sex is a product of being human, but the higher purpose of humanity is to subdue those desires so one can better connect with God. Can you just walk us through what that means and how you relate that to this very interesting title, The Kavanah of the Bedroom?
Yeah, of course. So Judaism cares a lot about what people think. Often, where your head is at when you're doing an action is almost just as important as doing the action itself. So therefore, mumbling through prayers is a very different act than saying a prayer and concentrating on what it means. And kavanah, that word, really comes to describe the act of having your head be in the same place as your actions are. And so what I went to look at was basically one simple question. Does Judaism care what you're thinking about when you're in the bedroom? And what I came to find actually is that where your thoughts are can fall into two different categories. One are the things you're allowed to think, and one are the things that you are not allowed to think. And Maimonides is part of this long 3,000-year-old conversation about basically where should your intentions be in the bedroom. And in fact, on a continuum from Maimonides to, and I draw it to the mystics, Maimonides is perhaps the most conservative of all the voices. So he actually believes pretty much there's one point to sex, and that's procreation. You having children, you fulfilling the mitzvah or the commandment, peru or revu, the first commandment in the Bible, which basically says you should be fruitful and multiply. And for him, sex was this necessary evil in which to have children and to check off a few key laws that you needed to do, things like giving your wife pleasure, things like that. But for the most part, sex was considered dirty or extraneous. It wasn't the rational way that he wanted to think. Now, throughout time, different people have given different measures for sex and why we should do it. What I went to look for in this essay was ultimately what those measures were to try and draw, is there an ethic, not just how you should behave, but also what you should be thinking when you're in the bedroom.
And so what should I be thinking?
Well, so let's start with the things that you shouldn't be thinking. So there's a very, very famous sugya or section in the Talmud in a tractate called Nidarim, around page 20b, I think. And it goes through and basically says that there are a series of ways that husband and wife can relate to one another, that if they have sex during that time, it actually, funny enough, makes a stain on the fetus. All right. So that a child is born almost with a mark against it. And many of those have to do with where your thoughts are. So, for example, it is against Jewish law for a husband and wife who hate one another to have sexual relations. It's also against Jewish law to have sexual relations while drunk, much to the chagrin of every 20-year-old in college. In addition to that, it's against Jewish law to to have sex when you're in an argument. And one that I found actually the most interesting, if a husband has already made up his mind that he's ready to divorce his wife, he is not allowed to have sex with her anymore. And so the idea being that there is a certain kind of purity that you have to enter into the sexual act with, and all sexual acts can be tainted by things like hate and anger and disdain and disgust. And if you enter into sex like that, it's not only not healthy for your couple, but it's so unhealthy, says our tradition, that in a way the results of that reverberate into future generations, which if you think about it, although we don't believe in the kind of cosmic way that the rabbis believed, there's truth, right? If two people who dislike one another have a child together and then ultimately will end up in divorce because they have an unhealthy relationship, that does actually affect that child in future years to come. And how many different people who are having trouble in marriage have tried to save their marriage by having children, much to the suffering of that child for the next generation.
Well, right.
When they realize that it doesn't work.
Yeah. And you know, from your own pulpit experience, as a lot of all of our colleagues do, is how many times parents try to work out their own issues through that third party, otherwise known as their child. And
absolutely.
That's the akedah every day. So what should I be thinking? Now we've walked through what I can't be thinking, but what should I be thinking? You know, it's almost like, are you going to, you know, the Peter Pan model, think happy thoughts and you will fly, or something to that effect?
Well, so let me give kind of the three paradigms. There's kind of three major paradigms that I unpack in the essay. The first I talked about is Maimonides, the idea that it's about procreation, sex is a necessary evil, just deal with it. And so where should your mind be? Your mind should be on the mitzvah of procreation, on the commandment of procreation. As you're involved in sex, you should be thinking to yourself, I hope this produces children. I hope these children are righteous children. I'm so pleased that I'm able to engage in this mitzvah. But there are two paradigms. One is kind of the middle road paradigm, which is the paradigm by a thinker almost contemporaneous with Maimonides in the Middle Ages, 12th or so century. His name is the Rived, Rabbi Abraham David of Pasquieres. And he actually comes up with four different rationales for why to have sex, one of which, of course, is procreation, but there are others as well. And so he articulates the idea that one can actually have sex for pleasure, and that's okay. His take, in a way, was not so revolutionary in the sense that that the rabbis in the Talmud were already talking about pleasure and sex. But nevertheless, it was one of the best articulations of kind of these multiple pillars or reasons why. And your way into sex could be multiple layered. And then you've got kind of on the extreme, which I hinted at before, the mystical way of seeing sex. And for them, they believed that that kind of heaven itself is split up into God being male and God being female. And there are parts of God that are male and parts of God that are female. And the problem is that the female part of God lives in exile from the male part of God for most of the time. And so that's, by the way, on Friday night when we stand up and we turn toward the door and we bow as the Shabbat bride comes in and we welcome the Shabbat bride in. What that really is, in kind of mystical terms, is the uniting of male and female. And for 25 hours during Shabbat, the universe is whole. And what they saw, and this is heteronormative, but it's to be understood that this is a text from its time. When male and female come together in the bedroom, they create a microcosm of heaven at its best. So during Shabbat, God's male and female parts are whole. During the act of sex, male and female come together, we are whole, and heaven is transposed into our bedroom, and we, like God, are a complete unit. And they say that it's a good idea to be thinking about that in the bedroom too. So you've got kind of a most extreme, just think about having children, all the way up to kind of the wildest mystical ride that you can think of. But the key, no matter what, is we're not Zen Buddhists. The idea is not to empty our minds of anything. The idea actually is to be thinking about things, and hopefully those thoughts are good thoughts. And they really believed in their very medieval way that our thoughts mattered. They, you know, there's number of stories out there, one of which I found the most interesting, about a husband and wife having sex, king and queen, actually. And the queen is on her back looking up and sees a checkered ceiling and is thinking about the ceiling rather than the act of having sex itself. And the child comes out checkered, which, though has never happened in the history of time, is nevertheless a good metaphor for the idea that, you know, where you're at in the moment matters, so much so that it carries on to the next generation.
You know, it almost sounds as if, Mark, that these stories and Midrashim from the Talmud and from the tradition really anticipate a lot of the scientific examination of sexuality now, that so much of sexuality is mental, that you know, how you think about things and triggers and really affects the physical. And it's fascinating. I mean, what you're doing, what you're writing, and what you're talking about is absolutely fascinating. And again, I think when you teach this, really shows a tremendous amount of insight from the tradition and from the rabbis who understood this on some level. Let me ask you, what's the role in your studies of Judaism and sexuality where the woman fits in? Because a lot of this one would perceive to be very male oriented. Where does the female component come in?
So that's a challenging question, because the truth is the rabbis were male, writing from a male point of view, almost blind to the female point of view. And I've studied actually a number of the texts that I write about with groups. I have a weekly Talmud study. And what's interesting is to see just like how challenging it is to leave aside the sexism that's inherent in the text, and to ask yourself, what can we redeem from this text that can speak to our own experience? So that same sugya, that same section that talks about the different things you're not allowed to think in bed, also talks about the idea that there was an argument at the time of the rabbis about what is proper for man and woman to do in the bedroom. And there's a minority opinion that basically says, you know, there are certain key sexual acts that are not okay, things like oral sex, things like seeing too much of each other's flesh. But then another rabbi comes in, which is kind of the mainstream view, and what they essentially say is, no, we are like cookers of fish. However we want that fish is okay, whether we want that fish fried or baked or grilled, no matter what, we can have that fish however we want. Which, if you think about the metaphor, is horrible. I mean, it essentially equates women to a piece of meat. And not only that, a smelly piece of meat at that. I mean, it's horrible. And so we have to come to terms with the fact that there are going to be different standards and different ethics in the way that our tradition views women than we have today. But nevertheless, there are important things to take from this. The idea that even so, right? And this is what I often tell my congregants to do. Even when you see something that's troubling like that, try and egalitarianize it, if that's really a word, right?
It is
try
now.
And make it so that male and female are equal. And then see if there's an ethic there as well. So don't say a man can do to a woman as they want. Say people can do to each other as they want, and then look at the argument again. Should we as a couple ascribe to a certain set of beliefs or values in the way that we relate to one another in a consensual way in the bedroom? Or is everything on the table as long as it's consensual? And the reading of that text is actually that anything's on the table as long as it's consensual. And so if you're willing to read women into the statement as well, rather than to see them excluded from the statement, then there's actually a tremendous amount of redemptive power in that statement, and a lot of important ethics to learn.
We're speaking with Rabbi Mark Katz on his studies and his essay around the book, The Sacred Encounter, Jewish Perspectives on Sexuality. It's part of the CCAR Challenge and Change series. It's published by the Central Conference of American Rabbis Press. You can get it from the CCAR also, I would imagine, Mark, on Amazon. Is that correct?
I think so, yeah.
There's an essay in the book by our colleague Jeff Dennis that talks about a very, very fascinating phrase called erotic theology. And he traces some of the language in the tradition of the marriage lover imagery of Hosea, Song of Songs, that's known to many. You've studied these issues. You're teaching it at the synagogue in Park Slope. This whole concept of this acceptance, if that's the right word, of a certain sense of eroticism within our tradition. Do you think we need to bring some of this back into the contemporary theology conversations or the way we perceive our relationships with God? I mean, it is from the tradition. We have this lover image, man and wife image, God and Israel. As you alluded to before, once you get off the literalness and you start to look at this language as metaphorical language, what do you think the implications are for contemporary Jewish sexuality?
So I think it's incredibly important. I mean, what you point to is actually two things. The first is getting back in touch with this language as a whole. Right? So there are certain key metaphors that don't speak to us anymore. So I remember reading Joel Hoffman talk about the idea that when we say Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, right? What we lack is actually an understanding of what a shepherd is. Because we think of a shepherd as a very kind of warm, loving character who's going to take us from place to place. But in fact, shepherds were very fierce. They had to be incredibly brave, right? One of the key things a shepherd had to do was fight off any predator that was going to be able to attack their flock. So shepherds aren't just warm and cuddly. They're also quite strong. And if we misunderstand how shepherds work, we're not going to understand the metaphor of the Bible very well. Well, the same applies to the lover or any of the kind of sexual theology that exists in the Bible itself. The truth is we all do engage in a sexual life. So we're a little bit different than someone who's never actually shepherded sheep before. But nevertheless, if we don't get in touch with our own sexuality, if we don't talk about it, if we don't explore it, then those metaphors are going to get lost to us. Because in fact, sexuality is such a wide, wonderful world. And if we're afraid to unpack it for ourselves, we're never going to be able to unpack it for the text and be able to see what the text means itself. In addition to that, you know, there's a lot that's in our tradition left over from an idea of sexuality that we don't talk about, right? So thinking about kind of Hasidic Judaism and the point of Hasidic Judaism to do this thing called Dvekut, which is to let your soul rise up and essentially cleave to God in oneness, that's a great idea. But if you take out the sexual nature of that statement, and you fail to understand that the idea of cleaving actually comes originally from Genesis, a man is going to leave his mother and cleave to his wife, and you don't see that relationship with God in sexual terms, you miss an important key piece of that metaphor, and you're unable to truly understand the point of, let's say, a nigun, or clapping one's hands, or praying with fervor, or shuckling while you pray. And so I completely agree that if you don't explore your own sexuality and you don't apply your understanding of sexuality to the many, many tasks and beliefs that are rooted in it, then there's absolutely no way you're going to get the full meaning out of so much of our tradition.
The meaning of words, as you're alluding to, is extremely powerful. So talk to me a little bit, if you would, about the word yada and the idea of to know and how it is played out sexually within the context of our tradition and how you see some of the deeper psycho-spiritual interpretations of this.
Yeah, so yada means to know, And often, especially in Genesis, this is a way that sex is talked about. And, you know, and Adam knew his wife Eve, and they gave birth to a son named Seth, who was the son that was born after Cain and Abel. The idea of knowing is incredibly important. And the way I see it, and this is contemporizing it, but this is the way that I've always thought about the term, is the idea that that you really, I mean, you build a world among yourself, right? Each person is an island or a planet among their own. And one of the amazing things about a couple is that you also build a world that is just you. I did two weddings this weekend, and both of the times I watched as seven circles were done at the beginning of the wedding, seven being the number of days that the world was created. And the point of seven circles is to create a world among husband and wife. And within that world, there's a tremendous amount to know and explore. And so as you're engaging in the act of sex, you're also learning about other people in a new way, and you're exploring this world that really is just for the two of you. And it's a wonderful and it's important. And over the course of time, you know, you grow together. And so I actually think it's a wonderful word for sexual relations in the Talmud.
Before we start running out of time, I want to ask you a little bit about some of the education components. There's some writings and essays in the book that really allude to sex education, the attempt on the part of congregations to really handle this. You're a congregational rabbi, you're dealing with teens, you're dealing with religious education. This is not the medieval period of time. You know, our kids, college, graduate school, many of them walk into you, as with me, they want to get married at 27, 28. They've been living together for 4 or 5 years, perhaps. The whole world of sexuality is so radically different now. How do you understand, given your Kavanah approach, given your understanding of the power and the meaning and the beauty of sexuality within Judaism, how do you begin to incorporate this into, very practically, the religious education of our young people so that they can understand this sense of Kavana, this sense of intention, this sense of equality, this sense of respecting another human being when the society seems to go so much against that?
Well, the way that I see it, if I were to convey anything to a teenager who was sitting in front of me, it's that there's an incredible power in sex and sexuality, and that no matter whether you acknowledge that power or not, it's there, it's under the surface. And so it is the power to hurt people, it is the power to heal people, it is the power to connect people, it also has the power to divide people. And so I would say that going into the act, understanding the immensity of it, right? I actually think that the mystics kind of had it right, that there's a certain kind of microcosm of godliness in the bedroom. And whether or not, and it's not my place actually to tell people if they're in a consensual relationship, whether to have sex before marriage or not to have sex before marriage, you know, or whether to explore their sexuality or wait, if they're doing it in a healthy way and they understand the power of what they're doing, they also understand the responsibility of what they're doing. I think that that's important, Kavanah. And I think that they're apt to make better decisions if they go into the act understanding the weight of the act rather than seeing it as, you know, fulfilling the flesh.
Do you think congregations should be teaching this as part of the religious school curriculum, starting perhaps in middle school?
Yeah, I do. And I also think that it's not just about sex, right?
No, it's
because
not.
At the end of the day, in middle school, you're not going to be talking to people about, you know, for example, the covenant of the bedroom, that essay. That essay really is for people who are much older than that.
Right, I understand.
But I actually think sex and sexuality start much earlier. I think they start with how you use your smartphone or how you talk to people of, you know, people that you are attracted to, whether the same sex or the opposite sex, or how you deal with desires that you can't really put your finger on. And I think from there, if you have a healthy relationship with those other things, then you're apt to be able to then, once you become sexually active, make good decisions. But I think that a lot of this is skill building. It's about not being afraid of sexuality. It's about learning to have open communication. It's about seeing sex as an avenue toward connection, rather than something that divides us. And if you can engender that in younger kids, in middle school kids, then when it comes time to have the real conversations about sex itself, when they get a little bit older, they'll be primed for that, and it'll be a much more productive conversation.
Do you, in your experience, are you still, do you think that despite the so-called openness of American society, that our people are still somewhat afraid to discuss their own sexuality? You think there's still a barrier there for, as you were talking about before, really knowing yourself?
Yeah, I do, very much so. I have been in a room with a lot of adults, and we've talked about a lot of sensitive stuff. I can't think of a time when the conversation has actually gotten into the personal of sex. People will talk about sex abstractly, but abstract conversations don't bring about healing and growth. Stories bring about healing and growth. Personalization brings around healing and growth. And the truth is, I'm not totally sure how to do that, because I'm not trained in that. And it can go into very, very difficult places, right? People in their history come to relationships with baggage. And for some of them, it's that they've opened up to somebody who then broke up with them, right? Or that they put their trust in someone who then broke it. And I feel more equipped to deal with that than I do to talk about someone's intimacy issues because of, let's say, being violated when they were younger. And if you're really going to talk about that, I mean, you have to leave space for that to come up. And I'm not sure whether or not any single rabbi actually feels comfortable with that enough to have those kinds of conversations.
Oh, no,
so it almost has to stay in the abstract.
It's a very and I know in a lot of the sacred aging work we do, it talks about second and third marriages, and the issue of sexuality comes up, and you know, I'm a big fan of really readjusting how people do premarital counseling for people who are getting married a second or a third time, where sometimes you're carrying into the bedroom memories, talking about kavanah, and intentions of previous husbands or wives, especially if there's a death involved. It's a very, you're right. I mean, the sexuality is a very, very complex subject, and one that really does need to be discussed within the, how you're doing it within the context of Jewish tradition. And I really thank you for that and to your contribution to the sacred encounter. And before we end, I just want to also mention, because you mentioned this before we started this, you talking about isolation and being cut off, and you have a book coming out in the fall of 2016 on what?
On Judaism and loneliness. It's called The Heart of Loneliness. And some of these issues come about in that book also. I have sections in there about the loneliness of growing old, the loneliness of losing someone, the loneliness of being single, loneliness in marriage. You know, every aspect of our lives can be an incredibly lonely experience. Even sex can be a lonely experience.
Oh, yeah.
You were talking a second ago, and I was reminded actually of a quote in the Talmud, Tractate Psachim, which says that a widow and a widower, when they have sex with one another, there are four people crying in the
right,
room.
Exactly right.
And so I think that, you know, part of part of the challenge, actually, about talking about sexuality, to kind of link the two works together, is the idea that there are no easy answers to questions around isolation, right? You can surround yourself with people and still feel incredibly lonely, or you can be totally alone and feel totally whole. And the problem is that sex can be an avenue to connection, but actually you can feel the most lonely in the bedroom as well. And I think that's partly where Kavanah comes in. If you know that the other person is thinking about you in the way that you want to be seen, and you're seeing them in the way that you think is healthy, that's when sex brings people together. Otherwise, when sex is between two people who are angry, or two people who don't like each other, or two people that have tension, that's when sex actually can drive people apart and be alienating.
We're speaking with Rabbi Mark Katz of Beth Elohim in Brooklyn, Park Slope, about the Sacred Encounter, Jewish Perspectives on Sexuality, part of the Central Conference of American Rabbi Challenge and Change series, published by the CCAR Press and also available on Amazon. Mark, thank you very, very much. If it's okay with you, when the book comes out on loneliness, we'll have you back, because that's a subject that comes up all the time and as I go around speaking on the Jewish sacred aging stuff. And congratulations on that. Congratulations on this essay. Thank you very, very much for your time and your expertise, and really just a tremendous amount to think about. I wish you just continued success and health. To all of you, thank you again for joining us on another edition of the Jewish Sacred Aging Podcast. Once again, you can reach us at the website www.jewishsacredaging.com and on the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we hope to see you soon on another Jewish Sacred Aging Podcast. Shalom.